Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up. With the economy his biggest calling card, why doesn't President Trump do more to avoid driving American families off a financial cliff? His niece, clinical psychologist Mary Trump, says the answers can be found in her blistering new memoir. And
for this to last, people need to be behind the scenes. It's imperative.
Fashion tackles racism. An exclusive interview with Edward Enfield, Vogue's first black editor, about the cover of the all-important all-black September issue. Then,
ultimately, I wrote this book because I wanted people to see the world that most people don't see.
Award-winning author and musician James McBride tells our Michelle Martin about his new book, Deacon King Kong, and staying optimistic in times of upheaval. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Crises have come to define Donald Trump's presidency, whether it's the COVID-19 pandemic that's left the United States with the highest death toll in the world, or pitting federal agents against American citizens in the midst of massive protests against racism, or indeed the financial hardship experienced by some 30 million Americans as they wait a now delayed but crucial extension of a benefits boost to weather this storm. And so far, Americans are unimpressed by the president's leadership because his rival, Democrat Joe Biden, is ahead in the polls, including in crucial battleground states that swept Trump into the White House in 2016. So who is the man in the Oval Office, really? Of all the books that have been written about him, my first guest tonight thinks that she is the best qualified to report from within. Mary Trump is the president's niece and a clinical psychologist. Her new memoir, Too Much and Never Enough, abandons family loyalty and the code of silence for an account of the uncle she simply calls Donald. And she joins us now from New York. Welcome to the program, Mary Trump. Can I ask you, you have some incredible sort of blockbuster revelations in the book. I just want to start by going back to 2016, the day after the election, before we even get to 2020. I was struck by a quote from yourself. You recall waking up early on the day after the election, and you say in the book, feeling as though 62,979,636 voters had chosen to turn this country into a macro version of my malignantly dysfunctional family. I mean, there's a level of detail there and a level of horror in your voice. Tell us again, I guess, what you were thinking. Why?
Yeah, I actually took it really personally, which is absurd because, you know, it's not as if those people were voting with me in mind. But I felt that even then there was enough information to make a somewhat informed decision. And the fact that so many people were willing to overlook so much was quite appalling to me, honestly. And it did feel like a situation I'd grown up with, in which no matter what Donald did, my grandfather kept enabling him and promoting him and overlooking his failures and allowing him to fail upward, if you will. So I knew that it would be even worse because we were talking about a man who was quite an incompetent businessman, and now he was going to be the ostensible leader of the most powerful country on the planet.
So we're going to delve a little bit deeper into some of your revelations. But first, I just want to ask you, because, you know, there's been obviously criticism and pushback. The White House calls your book absurd and ridiculous. Your uncle, Robert, who has also tried to sue on behalf of the family to prevent the book from being published, you know, talked about mischaracterizations just for financial gain. And I'm sure you're going to answer that in a second. But what I want to ask you, because we and everybody refers to you as you are a clinical psychologist. And some are saying, some in the psychotherapist world say, that, you know, a psychologist cannot have an agenda. They're not meant to be psychoanalyzing people who they're so close with. And I just wondered if that is what you're doing, and if so, do you have any ethical qualms or answers to that kind of criticism?
Yeah, oh, it's a perfectly relevant point to bring up. So a few things. First of all, I am not currently practicing. I haven't been in the field for quite a while. But that aside, even if I were a licensed practicing psychologist, I would feel that it was my responsibility to share what I believe is going on with a man who has so much power. You know, there should be a duty to warn. And I don't directly diagnose Donald, but I do point out how his behaviors can be understood in the context of what I regard as his psychopathologies. So what I don't understand is why more mental health professionals haven't spoken out, although some have, or why something like the American Psychiatric or the American Psychological Associations haven't rescinded the Goldwater rule, because the behaviors Donald exhibits are so dangerous that we need to, as American citizens and voters, need to understand what's going on. So if we can delve deeply into a candidate's physical well-being, I'm not sure why their psychological well-being is off limits.
Just quickly, what is the Goldwater rule for those who don't know?
Yeah, sorry about that. Back in the 60s, I think it was the American Psychiatric Association, when Goldwater was running against Johnson. Sorry, I don't remember. Anyway, mental health professionals were disallowed from speculating about candidates' potential psychiatric illnesses or psychological disorders.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're right. It was President Johnson or Lyndon Baines Johnson that he was running against. Let's just go forward for a little bit, because you talk in the book, you know, something that we're interested about on this program. We're a global news organization. We have a global audience as well as an American audience. And you talk about some of the global impact. You talk about, for instance, you know, you feel, you sort of talk about what many wonder, why somebody like Vladimir Putin or Kim Jong-un have such a kind of a positive effect, it seems, on President Trump. Yep. And you kind of draw a direct line from Donald Trump's relationship with his father, with his famous mentor at the time, Roy Cohn, the sort of pit bull New York lawyer. And you say that this have ramifications. You write, after the election, Vladimir Putin, Kim Jong-un, and Mitch McConnell, all of whom bear more than a passing psychological resemblance to Fred, that's your grandfather, Donald Trump's father, recognized in ways others should have, but did not, that Donald's checkered personal history and his unique personality flaws make him extremely vulnerable to manipulation by smarter, more powerful men. Expand on that, because many have tried to figure out what is the foreign policy objective and who has what on this president. You refer to Fred, Donald Trump's father, your grandfather.
Yeah. I believe that
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. There was a gap there, but it's very difficult to know what the policy agenda is. Quite honestly, I don't believe Donald has any policy agendas. His agenda seems to be whatever benefits him. And his alliances and allegiances seem to be with people who can help him, you know, promote himself, so to speak. So the reason he's attracted to people like Putin and Erdogan and Kim Jong-un is because my grandfather essentially made Donald eminently useful to more powerful men, as I say in the book. And he knows that he has to rely on people like that to help him accomplish what he needs to accomplish. At least he knows it on some level, because he's never been able to accomplish anything by himself.
That's really fascinating. And again, you quote now your aunt, Marianne Trump, the older sister of the president. There's an anecdote in which you write, on the eve of Donald's first summit with the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, Marianne called the White House and left a message with his secretary. Tell him his older sister called with a little sisterly advice. Prepare. Learn from those who know what they're doing. Stay away from Dennis Rodman and leave his Twitter at home. Your conclusion? Did you listen to any of those?
Not one. In fact, some of the headlines the next day were Donald saying that he doesn't need to prepare at all, and he's just going to trust his gut.
So, Mary Trump, do you feel that Marianne was also as worried as you, his older sister, who I believe is a judge?
Yeah, she retired recently, but she was a federal judge. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think she was probably even more concerned because she, as his sibling, knew him better than I did.
So let's just ask what you think. I don't know whether you've been in touch with Marianne, your aunt, since the book has come out. But you've seen in the last few days, this past week, the president cast, you know, a question mark tweet about the election. Of course, he was roundly, you know, pushed back by Republicans, by the Wall Street Journal editorial page, by many. But what do you think? You see trailing in the polls right now. How do you think he's taking that? And do you think there's any likelihood that he would not accept the result of the election, win or lose?
Yeah, that's a question that should be preoccupying all of us right now. But as for the how he's feeling about the polls, my guess would be that he's rejecting the validity of them because it's impossible for him to process the idea that he could be losing, you know? So he clearly doesn't, you know, accept that. But at the same time, on some level, he's got to know that there's a problem, because on some level, he knows that he's never actually won anything legitimately. What's interesting about Donald is he knows the difference between right and wrong. On the other hand, however, he's perfectly willing to accept any kind of help, no matter how illicit or potentially illegal it might be, to get him what he wants, which is why he's all of a sudden calling into question the validity of mail-in voting. He's all of a sudden claiming that the United States Post Office is, I don't know, like some kind of hostile entity that's out to get him. He will take help from a hostile foreign power if necessary. So that's one thing. As for whether or not he'll accept the results of the election, I think that depends very much on two things. If Joe Biden were to win, the margin of his victory is vitally important. So in other words, if it's an enormous margin of victory that nobody can question, right? That it would be impossible for anybody to have cheated or what have you, then I think Donald is much more likely, having been so narcissistically injured, to spin it away somehow and just avoid the pain of that and just claim that he can do something more important by being on TV as a correspondent for OAN or something. However, if it's close. Sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, Mary.
If it's close, then the second factor will come in to play, and that's the people surrounding him. His close inner circle of people are there because they're benefiting enormously from Donald's position in the Oval Office. So if it's a close election, they may very well convince him for their own benefit to fight and claim that the results of the election are illegitimate. And that's what worries me.
I want to ask you to go back to the youth that you are exploring, because obviously your own father, you know, he died in a sad and lonely place. Many people have talked to you about that. You know, he was, you say, driven to alcoholism and died alone. Donald Trump became the heir when your father, the eldest son, died. But you talk about his childhood and you talk about how he had been close to his mother, but his mother for a period of time had been very ill, for about a year was unable to properly care for him or the other kids. And that his father was not disposed to being a loving or sensitive father. And you write this, that Fred would, by default, become the primary source of Donald's solace when he was much more likely to be a source of fear or rejection, put Donald into an intolerable position, total dependence on a caregiver who was also likely to be a source of his terror. How much compassion do you feel for how you describe the family that he grew up in, the childhood that he experienced?
I have an enormous amount of compassion for all five of my grandparents' children. The house they grew up in was a cold and sometimes very scary and lonely place because of how my grandfather raised them. I think they were separated not just from the outside world, but from each other in ways that made it extremely difficult, if not impossible, for them to be allies and friends to each other. It's difficult not to have compassion for that very terrified, lonely, abandoned 2.5-year-old. That does not extend, however, to the adult Donald.
You know, we don't have a huge amount of time left, but I just want to ask you again, as you know, your own family, well, some of them have rejected this book and accused you of all sorts of disloyal motives. You yourself said that you felt, and I'm quoting, "I have to take Donald down." You have revealed in this book that you were the source of the huge treasure trove, I think 19 boxes, of tax records from the Trump family.
Right.
I guess, what is your motive? Do you hope that this book now, this close to the election, actually does play into the result of the election?
Yeah, and you know, whenever somebody repeats that quote to me, "take him down," it's a little bit overstated. What I meant was, I would like to have some measure of influence if I can. And what I mean by that is that I feel that in 2016, voters did not have all of the information, although they had some. So on November 3rd, I don't want anybody to go to cast their vote, no matter whom it's for, to be able to say that they don't know enough about Donald. So that was one of my purposes here. It's extremely important that he not get away with pretending he's something he's not.
Interestingly, we've got about 30 seconds. Some Republicans have said what you've said, that he needs to be beaten decisively if the country is going to stay, you know, on an even keel, and if the party is going to be able to continue. So I just wonder, you know, that seems to be, you know, an issue. Are you surprised that some Republicans are now coming out and talking publicly, whether it's the Lincoln Project or others?
The only thing that surprises me is that it's taken them so long. Honestly, I wish they had been doing this since 2015.
Mary Trump, thank you very much indeed for joining us tonight. Now, after the killing of George Floyd and amid the Black Lives Matter protests, many walks of life have been having their own long overdue reckoning with racism, even the fashion industry. 3 years ago, British Vogue elevated Edward Enninful to editor-in-chief. It was the first time a male, gay, and Black person held that position. And from the beginning, he said his Vogue would be all about diversity and inclusivity. U.S. Vogue longtime editor and Condé Nast artistic director Anna Wintour sang his praises in an interview with me last year.
And Edward has broken down those barriers and he's made it much more democratic. I think it's reflecting much more the makeup of Britain, the culture of Britain. I think he's obviously put a lot of wonderful African-American women on the cover of his magazine, as well as inside in the pages. And I think that he's very passionate about race. He's very passionate about politics.
Now, recently, Wintour has admitted to a hurtful and intolerant atmosphere at her magazine and not finding enough ways to elevate black editors, writers, or other creators. Well, Enninful has done all of those things, including making magazine history on Friday with the all-important September issue, the first cover to be taken by a black photographer. And we sat down here in London at Vogue to talk about his mission. Edward Enninful, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So I don't really know how to describe the September issue for non-fashion devotees. I mean, it's like Wimbledon, the US Open, the NBA Championship, the Super Bowl, all put together, right, for the fashion industry. Yeah. What makes it so important?
Well, someone said September is the January of fashion. So in our industry, you know, it's the one issue where everything comes together, all the stories, all the editorials, all the advertisers, really it's our fashion week in a sense. So yeah, the September issue is really the most important issue of the year.
And you've done something pretty different this time. You've got Misan Harriman as your cover photographer.
Yes, yes.
So tell me why that's important.
So Misan Harriman is the first black photographer sort of to photograph the cover of a September British Vogue issue.
And
ever in the history. And he worked with my fashion editor, who's also black, Donna Wallace, and a whole black team. And I think they brought something so authentic to the whole project. And for me, it was very important that we had a black team behind this.
Because, you know, you pull out this, as I think you call it the gate?
The gatefold.
The gatefold. Yes. And it's all these amazing Black Lives Matter activists. Even Jane Elliott, who is white, has done so much on the history of racism and the biology or the psychology of it. It's really incredible. You, since you took the helm 3 years ago, have you said you were going to make a difference? And you made a difference.
Thank you.
There were virtually, I think it was something like 12 black covers in 25 years of Vogue history, British Vogue. How has it been? What's the reaction been? And how do you feel about being in the vanguard of this cultural shift?
I mean, I remember when I got the job, I thought, what would I want to see in Vogue? And it was really, you know, I looked around the people I knew, I looked around the streets of all the major cities, and I just really wanted to represent what I saw in the magazine, which was inclusivity, diversity, you know, a place for women of all shapes, sizes, ages, colors to look and see themselves reflected. So that's what I really wanted to do. And the reaction has been so great from the industry, from you know, regular people to people like yourself. And I never thought it would sort of go this well, but I'm very happy it did.
And now, I wonder if you ever imagined that you'd be in the midst of this political, cultural, social movement. And be, again, on the front lines of this, because there's so much talk about change. And I just wonder whether for you it's a burden, is it an opportunity, do you believe that it will continue, or is it a moment in time?
I mean, you know, I've always done what I've done from, you know, very early on in my career. I've always sort of been about inclusivity, really, and sort of focusing on people you can label as the other, or people who've been othered. So I just wanted to bring them into this conversation. And I think what's happening now in the world is a great thing, because people are talking about subjects they never did before. Hard subjects, you know, racism, unemployment, you know, climate change. So the magazine, what we've been doing over the years, sort of, it's now the perfect conversation starter, really. But it wasn't planned that way. Just every month we try to sort of reflect what we see in the world out there.
I also find it really interesting because during lockdown, you've had several different issues, obviously, and several different, I guess, political or, again, cultural messages. One of them was reset. And it's about how you build back better, I guess, and how the nature and the environment. So you do a, not just fashion and the other, but also climate. And what was reset for you?
Reset for me was this idea of people thinking that we would go back to the world as it was before. I knew that world was gone. It was a new day. We had to reset not just the environment, but also our minds, our perspectives. And so for me, the word reset just meant a fresh start. You know, let's start all over. So for me personally, reset was needed, if you ask me. We were going too fast. You know, too many seasons, too many shows, too many designs, so much waste. So I think reset just sort of made all of us think and take a deep breath. Really.
So your cover features
Marcus Rashford.
The footballer who stepped out of his zone and did something political and again social to help children. Yes, he forced the British government to keep their school lunches program,
yes,
right?
Did.
Because they were going to cancel it.
Yes, he did.
You've got Adjoa Aboah on the cover too. Now, she is
My first cover girl.
And I interviewed her shortly after she was your first cover girl. So, and this is important, I think, because again, as I said, there were only 12 black models on Vogue covers in 25 years. So I asked her, does this really mean a real shift? This is what she replied.
Yeah, complete. As long as it's not a fad, as long as it's not a trend, and definitely with Edward, it's not. He has been advocating diversity for years and years and years.
Edward, I want to ask you, because you have seen so many fashion brands, corporations, everybody is rushing to join the Black Lives Matter bandwagon. Adwa said 3 years ago, as long as this is not a fad and just a moment, what does your gut tell you?
I mean, my gut feeling is, you know, whenever there's a moment, yes, people will jump on. But for me, I feel that we need to sort of call out all the different companies. It's not just enough having black models on your Instagram feeds or, you know, in magazines, because that's the norm now. But we need education. We need people behind the scenes who can get a seat at the table. We need, you know, bursaries for people. We need to find different ways of recruitment. For me, for this to last, people need to be behind the scenes. It's imperative.
Is it extraordinary for you, because you said, you know, Misan Harriman's cover had a whole black team behind him. We heard a lot 3 years ago when Tyler Mitchell did the first cover. He was the first black photographer to photograph US Vogue, and it was Beyoncé, done in a very sort of royal and amazing way. And I guess, is it extraordinary that it's taken this long to have a black photographer do the cover?
Yes,
I mean, seriously.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary. I guess, you know, fashion is so sort of based, trend-based and so cyclical, and, you know, what's happening now and what's cool now. But where British Vogue is concerned, I had Nadine Ejiwari, the first black female photographer to photograph a cover, January 2 years ago. So for me, the conversation just was natural and progresses naturally. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to wait for things to happen to jump on the bandwagon. And I feel some companies are virtue signaling, and that's the fear. But the ones who are doing real work are sort of doing all these things without behind the scenes and not necessarily telling the whole world about it.
So in this edition, you have a layout, a beautiful layout by Tyler Mitchell.
Yes.
And I want to ask you, because he, you know, he's spoken quite a lot about what it meant and what he photographs. He's got a new book and an exposition, right, an exhibit, that's titled I Can Make You Feel Good. And in a nutshell, as he puts it, it's the radical concept of seeing black people at leisure.
Yes.
And he called it revolutionary.
Yeah.
And to me, that seems very political.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it is?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're always, you know, seeing, you know, at work, you know, sportsmen. And the idea, and it's reflected in the story he shot for us, a couple wandering around Brooklyn wearing English checks in Brooklyn. So I love that, the contrast. But I think it is revolutionary, because we're not seen as, you know, out there, you know, playing golf, you know, we're always working or we're always, you know, protesting. And I think we need to be seen in a different light. Mm-hmm. And people like Tyler, people like, you know, Mesan really continue to show that Black lives are not just one thing. We're a varied race. We do lots of different things. We have lots of different faces. So, yeah, it is political in a way.
Because that's interesting, because I don't know how many Vogue editors admit to also being political.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wouldn't even say political, but I do know, I believe in education. I believe in educating sort of people. And I also believe in using my platform, whether it's, you know, my social media or the magazine, to help the world sort of understand.
Anna Wintour. She wrote about how sorry she was that there hasn't been historically enough inclusivity and the right working conditions and all the rest of it, inside and outside the cover. Do you think she's addressed it enough? Has she put that issue to bed, so to speak? Are you happy with the culture at Vogue and Condé Nast in general?
I mean, you know, I can't speak for Anna Wintour, I have to be very honest. But all I can say is I'm trying to do the best I can in Britain for British Vogue. And that means going back to what we talked about, you know, recruitment, you know, mentoring somebody for me is the greatest thing you could do. I had great mentors. So I make sure that I mentor people, that I advocate for the young, you know, the young. And in here in this building in England, we don't take diversity lightly or inclusivity or unconscious bias or, you know, microaggressions. We tackle this every day. We just brought in a sort of just, you know, diversity and inclusion officer. So I can speak for England and say, I won't stop until one day, you know, everyone's equal, really.
So you said in your Vogue editor's letter, June, I'm lucky to have enormous privilege in my world, but as a man of colour and as a gay man, I could not escape the sense that it doesn't matter what you've achieved or what you've contributed to society, your life can still feel worthless. And shortly a month after that, there was a very famous incident when you came into this building and the security directed you to the loading bay. How did you feel in that moment?
You know, to be honest with you, as a black man, it's not the first time I've been profiled. And it certainly won't be the last. But also, it wasn't an isolated incident. That's what I wanted to let you know. And for me...
You mean it happened to you before here?
Yes. It wasn't an isolated incident, because I believe in education to a point. But also, I
was going to ask you that, actually. Would it have been a teachable moment?
Yes, there was a teachable moment, but it gets to a point where it gone past that. Had I been younger, I might have been so upset I wouldn't be able to say anything. But now I can talk about it. Yeah. I've got the platform to speak about it, and I don't want this to happen to the next generation, to think it's okay. That kind of behaviour.
Tell me about your route to Vogue from Ladbroke Grove, which is a very, you know, actually, maybe when you were growing up, and it was very ethnically diverse, wasn't it? Yes. I mean, Ladbroke Grove, Notting Hill was very, you know...
The most diverse.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up with sort of, you know, black, white, Asian, gay, straight. For me, that was my world. And I remember I was spotted on a train by a famous stylist to be a model. So I did that for a couple of years. And then I was introduced to a magazine called ID. But I was always surrounded by my friends, you know. For me, what I learned from growing up in Ladbroke Grove is when we go up together, we all win. So I wasn't the one that had to be the only black person. I wanted my friends with me. So I brought my friends, Pat McGrath, you know, other hairdressers. Because together we all won. So that's how I started, and then I ended up sort of working on all these incredible stories for Franca Sanzani at Italian Vogue, who would literally make my dreams come true. She would, you know, commission everything I showed her, and then I worked on American Vogue for a bit, and then I was creative director at W Magazine. But through my whole journey, the message has always been one of inclusivity. It's not something I just started now, or even just started at Vogue. From my first ID cover was of a beautiful black singer called Rosala, and I was a teenager then. So for me, I've just sort of honed my voice and made mistakes and learned from them to arrive here today.
And then had a louder voice, the bigger the platform has
exactly.
been.
Exactly.
If Anna Wintour was to retire in any way, form or fashion, would you answer the call if they asked you to edit US Vogue?
I mean, it would be rude not to answer anyone's call, but I'm very happy where I am.
You are a diplomat, Edward Edinfor. Meghan Markle, when you were very vocal about your hope for the young generation of royals. And of course, she guest edited one of your issues. And now they've decided to retire from royal duties, Meghan and Harry. What's your reaction to that?
I mean, the Meghan I know, we're very close, is very intelligent. She's a great feminist and she does what is good for her and her soul, really. Working with Meghan on the September issue is one of the best experiences I've had because she's able to match you creatively, you know, politically. And I think whatever she's chosen to do now, whatever they've chosen, she really would have thought about it. And she'll be okay.
The iconic music magazine Q is folding after 34 years.
That's so sad.
Do you see, and Oprah's O is going online exclusively, do you see that ever happening to Vogue, or are you confident that Vogue can keep its paper issue?
I think Vogue would definitely always keep its paper issue. You know, it's the ultimate voice. It's the ultimate fashion Bible. And the beauty of Vogue now is that it's not just about the beautiful shoes and the dresses. You know, it talks about society and what's going on out, you know, going on out there in the world. That's what we're discussing. So I think Vogue will be around. But what is great now is the whole digital empire around it as well. You know, we take that very seriously.
One last question to wrap up on the September issue. If you were to say in a few words, what do you want the message of this issue at this time to be?
I want the message to be, despite the fact that we're going through probably one of the hardest periods in history, despite the fact that there's racism, you know, despite the fact that, you know, the world is not in its best place, these are people led by women, and we know, you know, women have had a hard time over the past, you know, in life generally, but especially the past 4 months, you know, through COVID, women have really, you know, whether it's healthcare, employment, women have really gone through a lot. And I love the fact that this movement in 2020 activism is led by women. Women are resilient. And so that's what I'm most proud of.
Fantastic. Edward Edinfor, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
And look out later this week for my conversation with the photographer, Misan Harriman, the man who made history making that cover. We turn now, though, to another creative heavyweight. Award-winning author James McBride has built a career exploring American culture and identity through his storytelling, starting back in 1996 with his memoir, The Color of Water, about his life as a biracial child growing up in Brooklyn. In 2015, he received the National Humanities Medal from President Obama for his lifelong work, quote, humanizing the complexities of discussing race. His next book, Deacon King Kong, looks at how communities pull together in the face of violence and trauma. And here he is speaking to our Michelle Martin about it from Lambertville, New Jersey.
Thanks, Christiane. James McBride, thank you so much for visiting with us.
Nice to be here with you again.
Well, you've switched up on us again. I mean, so you are a musician, first of all, a very accomplished one. And then you wrote an acclaimed memoir. And then you wrote a series of pieces based in history, sort of historical novels, as it were. And then short stories. And now this wonderful novel about Deacon King Kong. Without giving too much away, could you just briefly walk us through the premise of your latest book?
Deacon King Kong is about a deacon from an old deacon from a Baptist church who one day gets real drunk and he pulls out a gun and shoots the worst drug dealer in the neighborhood. He doesn't kill him, but as a result of that shooting, there's a wave of activity that allows us to see the entire neighborhood in a sort of caricature or funny way.
And then a lot of things happen. And then there are, you know, police are involved. And at some point there's a love story there. And it's just a very interesting thing to sort of think about.
Well, I mean, one act of violence rings for decades and decades and decades. And so in this case, this act of violence, it allows us to see the entire community's reaction to that piece of business, because ultimately that piece of business, It hits all the levers and gets all the elevators started. So we get to watch them go up and down and see how the dynamics of this one act moves this whole community to act in concert. Because in those days, in New York, a housing project was like a village. And in some ways, they still are. They're not quite as close now because people are texting and they can talk, you know, kids can talk to each other, you know, via text and so forth. But there's still a communication that goes on. And there was a communication that went on amongst these people who were pretty normal people who were seen as, you know, the poor. When in fact, you know, most of them worked. Most of them had jobs. A lot of them worked for transit. But ultimately, I wrote this book because I wanted people to see the world that most people don't see. And to see people that most people only see in brief, you know, from the wheel of a locked car or, you know, some brief news snippet or something like that. To humanize a part of the world that most people don't know that well.
Do you remember the germ of this particular book?
That's a very good question. No, but I run a program in the housing projects in Red Hook where I was born in it. And I meet with kids every weekend. We teach them music. I've been doing it for 7 years. And what I learned in that time is that there's not that much that's different. I mean, the people are different. There was more of an African-American and Puerto Rican and Dominican flavor to the projects back then. Now it's a wider, you know, wider range of raciality, Chinese, Dominican, people from Africa and so forth, people from so-called islands. But it's the same thing, hardworking people who are misunderstood, who manage to get along even though they're quite different. And you know, there's some drinking and there's some drugs. And even in my church, there's a little bit of tipping, you know. So there wasn't a germ of an idea, but what I suppose what it was, one afternoon I was with a student of mine from NYU, and he said, "Why are you here?" You know, and I said to him, "Because I love it here. I'm happier here than I am anywhere else." And I wanted to show that in a way that people would, I suppose, appreciate.
And I want to ask you to tell us a bit more about Deacon King Kong, which is a nickname on top of a nickname. And his other nickname is Sport Coat. If you wouldn't mind just reading a little bit and start with Sport Coat was a walking genius.
Okay. Sport Coat was a walking genius, a human disaster, a sod, a medical miracle, and the greatest baseball umpire that the Coors houses had ever seen. In addition to serving as coach and founder of the All-Coors boys baseball team, he was a wondrous handyman to the residents of the Coors houses, the guy you called when your cat took a dump and left a little piece of poop hooked in his duff, because Sport Coat was an old countryman and nothing would turn him away from God's good purpose. Similarly, if your visiting preacher had diabetes and weighed 450 pounds and gorged himself with too much fatback and chicken thighs at the church repast, and your congregation needed a man strong enough to help that track the trailer-sized wide body off the toilet seat and out onto the bus back to the Bronx so somebody could lock up the dang church and go home, why, Sport Coat was your man.
One of the things about this passage that I think infuses the whole book is that you're very clear-eyed about everybody's shortcomings, but it is also infused with so much love and appreciation for perhaps qualities that other people might not see. And your grace in this book does extend to some of the characters who are police. And one of the things that I noticed, particularly when you start introducing them at the very beginning, is a lot of them, you know, some of them are burned out and some of them have seen a little too much, but some of them are still really proud of the work and they really feel like they can make a difference. And I was just interested in that, especially the book coming out as it is in the current moment where a lot of people are very angry about the way the police function in this country and really want some massive changes. And so could you just talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, in general, in your art and in life, you have to give people a chance to say that I made a mistake. And if you don't do that, nothing's going to happen other than you forcing your will on them or they're forcing their will on you. So as a character, the police character in this book, for example, is an Irish-American cop from New York. And, you know, since this is a funny book, I mean, if you want funny people, you don't have to look any further than the Irish. Now, I don't want to get, you know, Jewish people mad or black people mad, but Irish people are very funny. And this cop happens to be very funny and very dedicated. And people like him existed and do exist. So it's easy to cite the negative, but it's better and stronger and more forceful. And it gives you a wider range of choices as a writer to work with the positive, because no cop wakes up wanting, I mean, no real cop wakes up wanting to shoot somebody. No real cop wakes up saying, I'm going to, you know, kill a black person. So the complexities that they have to deal with, the fact that they're often not trained for, not prepared for, is that really their fault? I mean, I'm not qualified to judge. But when you do judge, as a writer, there is no journey. So you can't judge. Because when there's no judgment, there's no journey. Without the journey, there's no story. That's not absolving some of these crooked cops from the murders. And I've had my issues with the police like everyone else. But the truth is, we remember the bad stuff they do. We rarely remember the good stuff they do. And that goes for every group.
The tone is hilarious, though. It's so funny. And the people are so funny. And I guess I just wonder, is that you? Is that how you sort of see the world? You see something that other people might find terrible and you think, well, that could be funny.
Well, yeah. I guess I like to laugh. But in general, this is a community that does laugh a lot. And it's because they laugh because they're powerless to do anything about it. So they just chuckle about it. And, you know, there's not, what else? What are you going to do? You laugh and you keep moving. And I wanted to communicate that the joy that exists in an area where that's so often seen as neglected and poverty stricken and pitiful and just slobbering over, you know, ham and cheese and whatever, you know. I mean, I just wanted to show that there's an enormous happiness that exists in this area. Now, I'm not saying that people wake up happy, but people know how to be happy. And that was at least the experience I had when I was a young man.
From the book, it sounds a bit of an elegy for what has been lost, that sense of gratitude, that sense of pride and joy in seeing something literally grow from seed. And that is a larger metaphor for everything, you know, your place in the world writ large, and just growing that from nothing and repairing that which is broken with whatever you have. And you really get the sense from the book that you have a sense that that's broken. So tell me what your source of joy and optimism is about now.
Well, working with that very good, you know, very profound piece of business that you just laid forth, our young people today have no seed to work with. We've given them nothing to work with. They've created the seed out of air. They've seen, I mean, many of them have never had the experiences that they're having in these past few months. And their sense of justice combined with their innocence, if you will. We're watching the birth of a new generation that has done something extraordinary. They're creating something out of nothing. I mean, that's really the story. I think that's the story of our time, because these kids are out here marching, and many of them are not black. And they are saying, we want real justice. And they're saying in a way that, and, you know, older people say, well, you can't do that because, you know, they don't want to hear it. And they're suffering for it. And this will mark them for the rest of their lives. And they will have this as part of their machinery, as their inner machinery. And that's only going to make us a much better and much stronger place. I'm so proud of these kids. When all this started happening, I couldn't believe it. And I felt that, I mean, I'm not criticizing the coverage of it, but I just feel very proud and very hopeful seeing that these young people have taken the business of justice upon themselves to try to get things straight, because there are parts of this country that I never really noticed. I never really paid attention to those Confederate statues. They never bothered me. I walked by them just like I walked past a bird snatching a crumb off the ground. I wouldn't even pay attention to it. Some of this stuff never, quote unquote, bothered me. But they are dismantling institutional racism. And that's quite a task. That's quite impressive. That's nothing we didn't give them much to work with. They created this themselves. They're creating their own song with their own instruments and their own music. And our best bet is to listen quietly like a good audience and clap at the end. And when they pass the bucket around, dig in our wallets and take out as much as we can.
It's just interesting that this book is based in 1969. It's not like there was nothing going on back then. 2 years after the first series of, you know, big social unrest, big uprisings in the streets in 67 and then in 68. So 69 was, people were still kind of like, whew, I think, trying to figure out like what just happened and what's going to happen next. And I wonder, like how you see yourself in this current moment. Do you see yourself as having some specific role, particularly as an artist?
Now?
Yeah, now.
Not really. No. I never, that's a really good question. I've kind of, you know, I kind of stay out of that because there's so many people who talk about it. I'm not interested in talking about it. I'm only interested in doing something. I only care about solutions. I know what the problems are. You know, I figured them out at Oberlin College back in 1975 at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, I mean, we just worked it all out. And then the next day I got up and racism smashed me in the face like a bottle, just like it did the day before. I mean, I've been through all that. I'm only interested in solutions. I'm only interested in doing things that help the community and that and people who work there. I don't want to hear someone speak about it. I don't want to join a committee. I'm not interested in any of that stuff. Every Saturday morning, me and my son, we get up at 5:30, at 6 o'clock, we're out the door, we're in Red Hook, we're set up at 8:30, 8 o'clock, and we work all day. And we do that, and we've done that consistently for the past 7 years. That helps me sleep at night. Is that enough? No. But, you know, I do support the causes, financially support the causes I believe in. But no, I'm not one of these writers, because I'm not interested in telling white people what they did wrong. Racism's not my problem. It's their problem. I remember Kurt Vonnegut, when I did a reading with him once, and a lady raised her hand and she said, "Why aren't you writers writing against the war in Iraq? You are writers. You need to stop." And he said something I'll never forget. He said, "Miss, we're not that powerful. If you don't want to believe what we write, you're just not going to believe it. So, you know, there's only so much we can do." And I feel that way as well.
Of course, for people who've read your memoir, The Color of Water, which is now a classic. I mean, I feel comfortable in saying it's this incredible story, you know, of your mother who raised you in an African-American neighborhood. Your dad died when, sadly, she was pregnant with you. She raised first 7 children and another 5. And you later understood that she was white. You didn't really notice that at the time or think about it at the time. And for some reason, it just made me wonder. I'm just saying, when you brought her up, I was thinking about her myself. I'm not sure why that is, but do you ever wonder what she would have said about what's going on right now?
Well, she would have said, you know, if she was living, she'd say that, you know, she'd say, "Make sure you stay out of it." You know, that's what she would definitely be terrified. Don't you go in, you know, but, I think she would be pleased to see that some of the things that I mentioned earlier, my surprise to seeing these Confederate statues coming down and this whole business of institutional racism being addressed. I think she would be pleased to see that happen. On the other hand, she always felt that, that the whole business of racism and white people's racism would never change. Hmm. Because she had grown up in the South. And so that's why, you know, she didn't raise us as mixed children. She was pretty clear that, you know, you're going to be seen as black and you better just get yourself together. There was no excuses. You know, you came from school with bad grades. She didn't want to hear that. It just wasn't accepted. So I think she would be pleasantly surprised. And she went through her own metamorphosis as the book came out and she began to meet her family. She met her sister and so forth. So she began to evolve into a fuller person as she grew older. But I think she would be ultimately pleased. I mean, my life has unfolded so much in the last 10 years since she died that I have a hard time remembering her. Like I sometimes think this really didn't happen. What did she really, was that my mother? Because she seems so distant now. It's some people have, you know, like my sister's dream about her. I very rarely, once in a while I dream about her. But I tell you this, when I walk into the church in Brooklyn every weekend, I feel her spirit fully, all in that little tiny building.
I have observed that many of the young people, maybe not just young people, but I feel that there's a sense of despair right now in this country. First of all, people's objective circumstances, many of them are very difficult right now. You know, we have tens of millions of people who are unemployed at the moment. We have people who are very fearful of illness. They are, you know, we are currently in the middle of this global pandemic. So I guess what I'm just asking you is, as a person who meets the world in a sort of an optimistic way, do you have some words of hope for people right now who are afraid?
One of the things that you have to learn to do when you get older is you have to learn to appreciate everybody where they are. Even if you don't like them personally or politically, you have to try to appreciate them where they are. So I would urge people to remember that these are the war stories you'll tell when you're an old man or an old woman or an old person. And you just have to don't take it too seriously. It will change. Just have a good time as much as you can. You know, as long as you're not starving. I know some people are struggling now, but it will change. And you just have to stick in there. It's all right. It will be all right. You just have to keep to the sunny side of the street a little bit and know that in a short time, things are going to get better.
James McBride, thank you so much for talking to us.
Well, thank you. Delighted to see you finally.
So, and finally, we give thanks and remember the peacemakers. Northern Ireland politician John Hume has died at the age of 83. He was a Catholic and an Irish nationalist who believed deeply in unity and helped negotiate a solution to a fair and just end to the Civil War. Hume was a driving force behind the 1998 American and British-sponsored Good Friday Peace Agreement that brought an end to British rule over the territory and an end to three decades that were euphemistically called the Troubles. In 1998, John Hume was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, along with Protestant leader David Trimble. And that is it for now. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.